food addiction. This is a concept that frequently comes up when we're talking about the obesity epidemic and about excess weight. It's a controversial issue. Can we really be addicted to food, something that is so essential to our survival? How do palatable, aka yummy foods, act like drugs, or at least have the potential to do so? And even if food doesn't fit the classical definition as a drug, does that mean that we're not motivated by reward to consume again and again, despite our judgment otherwise? And finally, does it even matter if we define food as an addiction or not? Today, I'm bringing back a conversation with addiction specialist, Dr. Vera Tarman, to get to the bottom of all of these questions. This is a really informative episode and a great way to round up our summer series. I will be back next week with a fresh lineup of brand new episodes, so make sure you join me then. In the meantime, enjoy this replay of Food Addiction, Fact or Fiction.
Hi, this is Dr. Adrian. Welcome to Health Bite, the podcast where we explore all things health and wellness.
This episode of Health Bite is sponsored by Dell Nutrition, a line of functional nutrition bars and supplements I have personally curated to enhance health and well-being. You can find out more at dellnutrition.com.
Welcome back, friends. We are well into the summer season, and whether you want to lose weight or not, I bet somewhere in your mind, when you think summer, you think weight. Or if you don't think about weight, you think about your body or its state of affairs. It's in our culture and it is indoctrinated. So instead of pretending it doesn't exist, let's address it, but in a different way. Welcome back, Health Bite family. My name is Dr. Adrian Udim, and this is Health Bite, the podcast dedicated to providing you with small, actionable bites towards greater physical, mental, and emotional well-being. Let's face it, the wellness and weight loss space is filled with nonsense. I created this podcast as an alternative to the noise, to provide you with knowledge-based guidance in the areas of nutrition, fitness, habit change, and mindset that I use in my medical practice with my patients every single day to help empower you for change. Can't wait to share this episode with you. Today, I talked with Dr. Vera Tarman. She's an addiction medicine specialist, and we talked about food addiction. Is that even a thing? We also talked about my love of sour gummy worms, Sex and the City, and a bunch of other cool stuff. So get cozy and get ready to dive in. I'd love to hear your thoughts about this episode, so please share and let me know what you're thinking. Here we go. Hi there, and welcome back to Health Bite, our podcast where we talk about all things health and wellness. Today, I am really pleased to be speaking with Dr. Vera Tarman. She is a physician specializing in addiction medicine and the medical director of Renaissance, an addiction treatment center in Canada, a very large addiction treatment center, as I understand. She is also the author of Food Junkies, Recovering from Food Addiction. And so welcome, Dr. Vera.
Thank you. Thank you very much for asking me to come here to speak today.
It's a pleasure. And I think this is such an important topic. And before we dive in, tell me a little bit about what brought you to this area of medicine. What inspired you to do this work?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you so much for asking me to speak, not just because it's a nice venue to speak, but also your perspective, you coming from the obesity field as a clinician, because I think that we need to be speaking with each other more. So I'm really, really happy that we are. I come from the addiction background, and, you know, we don't read each other's literature because, you know, addiction doctors read ours and you read yours. So it's really nice when we collaborate like this, because I think it's so important to do so. My background is that I have been working in addiction medicine since, 2000 or something, like a long time now. And one of the things that I discovered, because I work in a treatment center, I work in new recovery, people just coming in from stopping their alcohol, their cocaine use, their crystal meth use, whatever, is something usually that has been so dominant in their life that they, you know, are willing to give up a month of their life to come into treatment. So we're not talking about just, you know, a little bit of a struggle, but big time struggle. And so what I would see happen on a repeated basis is that people would would put down their alcohol, put down their cocaine, and then they would start eating. And they would say, I never used to eat like this. Why am I eating like this? Once I started to, you know, as it were, put on those glasses and see it, I saw on a regular basis that people were behaving just as addictively with their food as they were with their previous drug. And so I probed a little further, and often I would find that they actually had a history of difficulty with eating before they found their substance. They found cigarettes, they found alcohol, they found cocaine that curbed their eating. Now that they're stopping, it's come back. This was just something that I became aware of. And then in the late 90s, I started to see literature in the addiction field starting to talk about, you hear in the research about, the rats that choose sugar over cocaine, that kind of stuff was happening at that time. And I just thought, oh my God, I've got research to substantiate this clinical syndrome that I keep seeing, and started to speak about it at that point. And that's when I started to talk to people more, clinicians more. And it's like, this is not just my experience, my patient's experience, this is across the board. And why are we not talking about it? So I got on a bandwagon or a campaign, as it were, even from those days. And it's just sort of blossomed into something. We're not yet at the tipping point, but you know, things like this interview today, you know, you're coming from an entirely different discipline that we're talking, and I have a feeling we're on the same page, you and I, just from a slightly different perspective. And I think that that's just wonderful. So that's where I come from.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, we do need to be talking to each other more. We do need to be collaborating so that we can serve people better and ourselves better, quite frankly, because we're all human. And so, yes, I agree. And I'm happy to be doing this as well. I'm really interested in, you know, what you mentioned about, you know, going from cocaine to food or alcohol to food. And it made me think about something I used to see when I worked with the bariatric surgeons that had been termed transference or transfer addiction, where people post bariatric surgery, for example, and their studies published to show this, had a greater incidence of maybe alcohol use or abuse or other substance abuse after bariatric surgery. So it kind of goes both ways, it sounds like.
It absolutely does. And I'd like to ask you this question, because I went to a bariatric conference in Florida a couple of years ago and asked a few of the surgeons, you know, what is it with this phenomena of increased alcoholism post-surgery? It didn't seem that everybody agreed with that. So, I mean, I'd like to ask you, is that a well-known factor? Is that just something that you've picked up and that it's only some people are talking about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe not everybody is talking about it necessarily, but it's definitely something that is well published in the literature. And in fact, there was a New England Journal of Medicine article by a Dr. Adams out of Utah, who's an internist who does a lot of this prospective work. And he showed that, in fact, suicides and accidental death, while patients who had bariatric surgery had less likelihood to have cardiovascular death or diabetes-related or cancer-related deaths because they had lost weight, right? They did have a higher incidence of accidental deaths and suicide. And so it is important to talk about, and it's not about vilifying one thing or another, one treatment or another. I'm very much about utilizing all the treatments that exist. But we need to be aware. And I think the surgeons, because sometimes they are really, their work is to do the surgeries, right? They do the operations and they may or may not have that longer term follow-up. It rests on maybe people like you and I to be more aware and to have that, you know, in mind.
Yeah, and to fill in some of that background, because so that's a little piece that I didn't know. So what I saw, I mean, here we can fill the holes together here, because what I would see is that, yes, post-surgery, there's increase in alcoholism, and there's also increase in weight. Now, you know, there's certainly this drastic weight loss, but then there's a gradual basically regain over usually post 5 years or something like that. And I bet you that's when the suicidality could come, because how depressing it must be and discouraging it must be to have gone through the effort of all that work of surgery only to get it back, the weight back. But if we had this extra piece, like there's an addictive element in here, we could nip that in the bud.
So I want you to dive into that a little bit deeper, because I know there's controversy around this topic of addiction and whether addiction really exists. Can we apply the term addiction to something like food, which is so essential to life? So I'd love to hear like your perspective and why you feel comfortable or feel like it's important to actually use the term addiction when it comes to food?
First of all, just to state out very clearly that it's a very controversial area. It's not in the DSM-5, although the DSM-5, it's not the DSM, it's the ICD, is now being renegotiated. And so we've actually put in, because we know it's a sort of big lobby effort to try to get a diagnosis in. And so we're trying to get it in. It's very difficult because people will say this is an essential item. Even within the ranks, we're fighting with this concept of, should we call it food addiction? Should we call it sugar addiction? How about processed food addiction? I mean, food is just too big of a word. And from somebody like me, where I see end stage, I'm an addictions doctor. Like I said, the person's got to be bad enough that they're willing to give a month of their life and lots of money to come into treatment. There's a gradation of addiction. So I'm seeing people at the extreme end stage of behavior that fulfills all the criteria of addiction, which I can talk about in a minute, but just to say, it fulfills all those criteria, even normal food, not necessarily processed food, because once you get to the end stage of addiction, it can be even celery. You can eat too much healthy food. It could be just processed eating or volume eating. It's no longer just sugar or processed foods, which it's often where it starts. So it's like a continuum. And when we talk about food addiction, we're saying it starts with just living in today's food environment, which is full of, basically processed foods. They're not really foods anymore. Like if we were talking about real vegetables, real fruits, we wouldn't be having this conversation. It's basically starting with the hyper-processed food and sugar. So even a person who's not food addicted will find that it's hard to have only a few of something because the food is made to be addictive or hard to not eat. We may not call it addiction. The food industry calls it craveability. It's just hard to not eat it. So you can start at that level of struggle with eating, and then that can morph itself the more exposure you have to it. And if that's all you're eating, that's a lot of exposure versus somebody like my generation, where it might have just been on weekends or birthdays or something like that, not so much exposure. But today, that's all people are eating. So they're moving along, and just like we're seeing teenagers and people in their 20s getting diabetes and metabolic syndrome. We're seeing people getting food addiction at a younger age because it's not only like hyperinsulinemia in the body, it's hyper dopamine in the brain. I actually think they're very similar processes that's happening in the brain with addiction. So you have this exposure and you develop the characteristic features of addiction just the way that you would develop the characteristic features of insulinemia,
And so can you define what are those characteristic features of addiction?
Yeah. So if a person pulls out the on the internet, the 20 questions of am I an addict, it'll be the same ones for alcohol, cocaine. Am I a cocaine addict? Am I a food addict? It'll be basically a bunch of questions which are trying to measure certain parameters, or like I'm going to say five qualities. And the first quality is obsession. And this is the dopamine piece. So if I find that I like a bag of chips and I have a couple of them and now I want a few more and I'm telling myself, no, I can't have a few more, but I still want a few more. I'm not addicted and I'm not even obsessed, but I'm thinking about it a bit more than those chips deserve. Now, if over time I become reliant on that big bag of chips to get through the night while I'm watching Netflix, now it's become more mental real estate. And at a certain point in time, over time, if that's all I'm eating, it becomes an obsession. It may not feel yet like an obsession, but it's certainly has more dominance than it should. And that's the hyper dopamine effect.
Yeah, which just means that I think obsession sometimes has this feeling or connotation to it, but it just means you're thinking about the darn chips, like you said, more than you need to, right? And that often happens with chips or, you're thinking about something, you're telling yourself to resist, and then lo and behold, you find yourself distracting yourself or trying, but yet you keep thinking about that thing in the pantry, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a gradual process. So it starts from just, thinking about it to craving it and then eventually to obsessing. So that's the first thing, is this hyper attention. Inevitably, what happens is you have a few and they're great. And then the next day you need more to get the same effect. And it might not be the next day, but soon enough, you need the whole bag. And at a certain point, if you've had a really bad day and you really want that feeling of those chips, you got to have two bags. So essentially there's an odd kind of tolerance that develops. Or we just need more to get the same effect. So that's number two. So you're eating more, not necessarily to feel more, but to feel
what you felt to begin with. Yeah.
Exactly. So even though it doesn't feel like more, you've now put more mental investment, which is more obsession, and also more impairment is happening because you're having four bags instead of two. So now in four bags of chips instead of two bags, that's going to cause problems with my diabetic profile. Even though it feels like two, it's the effect of four. So impairment is happening, not even with me noticing. So we've got obsession, we've got tolerance, essentially, we've got impairments happening. And then finally, one of the final stages is where you say, I've got to stop. This is not good. And if you stop, well, now, I mean, tell anybody who's used to using food to get through the night, tonight, you do not get to have your favorite tub of Häagen-Dazs. It's the same as you don't get to have your bottle of wine. You don't get to have whatever it is. You got to get through that night on your own. And the person who balks at that and says, how do I do that? Well, they're essentially, we can call it deprivation if you want. I'm going to call it what it is, which is a sense of withdrawal. How will I be without this substance that I've become dependent on?
I'm accustomed to. It's just habitual.
Habitual, yes. And I will now suffer if I don't have it, which we call withdrawal. And all of that stuff. So we've got obsession, we've got impairment, we've got tolerance, we've got now withdrawal. And then the final picture is denial, where because of the way addiction works in the brain, the delusional aspect of this mental disorder, because it becomes a disorder, it's actually a neurological adaptation to an abnormal environment. But it looks like a disorder. And the disorder is, it's not a problem because it still just feels like two.
And you know what I would love for you to do, because I think this is going to resonate with a lot of people, even if they don't have like food addiction. I mean, I think there's certainly times when I've shared on this podcast before that I have a personal love for sour gummy worms. Actually, there's sour gummy anything. Like I don't restrict myself and discriminate against anything else, like unworms. They could be octopuses. They could be sour bears, fish. But I know that if I start and it's sitting in my drawer, I'm going to consume it. That's something that is kind of normal human behavior. What I want you to talk about, though, because I don't want to pathologize this for people too much, is talk about kind of the neurochemistry and what physiologically, like this is not a moral flaw, right? But what happens in the brain? Talk to us about that.
Okay, but first of all, just to use your example, you have your sour gummy bears. Now, when it becomes a disorder or pathological is, if they're there, are you able to, like, you know that they're there, you've had your amount that you think is appropriate for the night, and you know that they're there, is your mind continually going there, and so that you cannot stop thinking about it unless you go and have the rest of them?
You know, I think it depends. I typically know that I can have a few and then I put them away. But if I feel like I'm in that mode, you know, I'm not going to lie, I've had a bag of gummy worms before.
Okay. So some of the specific questions about, am I a food addict, are, do I throw away food and then go back and get it later? Do I steal food? So I'm breaking rules I would normally not do. Do I hide food from people when they're coming over and I don't want them to have my stuff, so I hide it? Am I willing to go to all lengths to get that favorite food, including in a blizzard, I'm going to drive all the way down to the other side of town because I want that specific gummy bear that they have there and they don't have it next door? So we're talking about behaviors that are far out of the realm. And if I don't have that, is that going to persistently affect my mental health? Because it's there and I still know there's a way to get it. I just have to find a way to get gas.
You know, it's really interesting that you say that, because just a few weeks ago, I had a conversation with one of my patients who actually, you know, she was kind of on the leaner side. She was a very petite older woman, had gained about 10, 12 pounds, and as a result had insulin resistance and high blood sugar. And her doctor wanted to put her on treatment, put her on metformin, and she really didn't want to go on metformin. And so she came to see me. One of the things that she brought up, and she was so kind of almost embarrassed really to share with me, was that she loves ice cream, and there are times that she'll throw the ice cream away and then she'll go back in the trash and get it. And she told me that on one particular day before she'd come to see me,
She had previously been a smoker, had stopped smoking. She literally went and got a cigarette to stop the ice cream and then still was going back for the ice cream. So then decided to like put the cigarette out in the ice cream. Funny enough, that was like an episode on Sex and the City. Like, this is a real thing that people do, right?
It's a real thing. People have put cat litter in their garbage because they're afraid they're going to go back later.
So again, I want to kind of normalize the experience. I'm going to take you back to the physiology because it's really impressive brain chemistry that's happening here.
Yes, it is. It is. But let me just do one little piece more. And another, and then I promise I'm going to go to the dopamine piece. You see, the other question is, have you ever lied about your eating because you're so embarrassed about it? Do you eat differently by yourself than with other people? Are you embarrassed about this whole thing? Like, those are all pieces that fit into that paradigm of addiction. And if there's anybody listening and has checked off everything that I've said, I think you should read my book. I think you should consider this as a possible diagnosis for yourself.
Just to add to that is that, you know, a lot of times these things are continuums, right? So we don't need like a diagnostic code, but maybe some people, you know, certain things that you're saying resonate, but they're like, I don't really do all of those things. But I do think that talking about the fact that these are common experiences or that you've heard of them, I've heard of them, I love gummy worms, whatever the case may be, it kind of normalizes it, again, to use that word, and takes the shame away. Because I think a lot of times, right, we could do better for ourselves. And yet having that self-judgment around it prevents us from going there.
But so the way we can get rid of that judgment is to do exactly what you're saying, which is to start talking about the physiology behind this. This is the brain doing its job in an abnormal environment. And so what happens is that we have a natural dopamine cycle in our brain, like it's in, you know, the reward pathway, the limbic system. And it's, I have dopamine, which is my anticipation of good things to come. It's my, excitement, my pleasure, my looking forward to nice things, like, I'm going to have something nice to eat in a few minutes. That's a normal thing.
It's like the pleasure hormone that gets, or neurotransmitter that gets released in the brain, and it gets released in everyone's brains, whether it's food or sex or even like really good conversation like we're having right now, right?
Yes, exactly. And just wanting to know what you're going to say next is dopamine. It's like, I want to know what's, I usually say it's the want hormone. I want to know hormone, or the like curiosity hormone, whatever, not hormone, neurochemical. So we've got dopamine, and it's a normal like fuel for us to carry on through the day in terms of mood. And what happens is that there's sort of normal checks and balances. So when we have a conversation, you know, there's only so excited or curious I am about what you're going to say. However, if you're about to promise me the possibility of $1 million, in other words, gambling, then that's out of the norm. And so there's explosion of dopamine because I'm, oh my God, I might really win the Nobel Prize, or you're going to tell me something really huge. That, you know, those occasional extraordinary experiences, which are sort of extra dopamine, which are motivators, I'm going to work really hard because I want that Nobel Prize or that book published or whatever it is. Those are motivators, but they're not meant to be, I'm not meant to be up there all the time. So my brain is not going to adapt to that. But if I'm in an artificial environment, food environment, drug environment, that moves the norm of dopamine up higher than it normally is, then my brain is going to start to readjust to that, which is what we call tolerance. And all of this is happening at a primal, instinctual part of the brain. It's not the cognitive part.
Right. Meaning that you're not thinking yourself, you're not willing it. It's happening.
It's happening even before you know and will it. Yeah, exactly. And so that's partly why you can't use willpower in addiction. The best way to treat addiction is to change your environment so that you don't respond addictively. In other words, people, places, things, don't have the thing around, get support, all that stuff. To rely on willpower.
In the end, it fails. Yeah. You know, I want to also bring back up what you brought up about the two chips or whatever the case may be, no longer cutting it. And then you have to have more in order to feel it. That's also dopamine, right? So talk about how that works.
It's the tolerance. So I want that dopamine, which is the feeling of two, and then, oh my God, it's really nice if I have three. And so I want that. And at the moment you know you can have that, dopamine is anticipation. So I'm anticipating. And so many times people in any drug will say, I don't even like this because they don't feel the effect, but they think the next one is going to do it. Even the crack user is going, I hate this stuff, but if I do one more, then I'll get where I want to get to. People who are binging are shoving the food in. They don't even taste the food, but they're thinking the next one and I'll get that satisfaction. But of course, it doesn't happen that way because dopamine is the chase. It's the I want. And you just end up wanting ferociously without getting the conclusion.
I think that's so, I want to slow that down because that's so important, right? I think it's really important to remember that the dopamine is driving the chase, as you mentioned, the wanting, with the intention or the belief that the next bite or the next drink or sip or drag or whatever the case may be is going to give that person that feeling of euphoria, really, that feeling of high, you know, off of, or goodness off of that next thing. But the dopamine is like, it's tricking you. It's just dragging you along like a dog on a leash, right? And I think, yeah, it's so important to say that because it really like, it really in practical terms describes such a common experience. And again, this is not frontal lobe activity. It's not willing it, it's happening.
Like I said, we're responding to an abnormal environment. A normal environment would be, for example, I'm really hungry, so you give me a plate of Brussels sprouts. And the Brussels sprouts are delicious because I'm really hungry. So my dopamine is looking forward to that. I eat the food. Once I'm satiated, you know, we've got leptin, we've got the hormones that make me not want to eat. So I'm full. Like there's a sort of natural checks and balances so that the dopamine is dampened after the plate of Brussels sprouts. And I don't want any more. I'm not hungry anymore and I don't want anymore. And so my ability to say no, I've had enough, works. But when we've got gummy bears or chips or something which is fueling a little bit more, even though I'm saying actually I'm full, I should really stop, the want and chase is still bigger. And because it's no longer an equal opportunity thing, it's you know, the dopamine is heightened, and so the ability to say no is still there, but it's not loud enough because the dopamine is louder.
Yeah. And the point being, you know, you bring up Brussels sprouts, which I actually love too. But the point being, right, that these foods that are highly palatable, so high fat, high sugar, give you more of a zing. It gives you more of like that dopamine zing. And so that's why we don't binge on Brussels sprouts. But when these things are so entrenched in our environment, you can't even walk down the street without getting a whiff of like French fries, right? So you're being bombarded by all of these cues to your environment, which I think we're going to get to based on what I'm hearing. But, you know, the environment is really bringing all of these things to you on a constant inundating basis. And so, you know, to respond is kind of human.
It is. I think that you're really keen to tell your listeners that this is not a pathology. We're living in a pathological environment and we are responding normally to that pathological environment. And what we need to do is change the environment. And then if we're not too badly damaged, we can readjust. It's just like once you're a diabetic, you're never no longer not a diabetic, but you can become a functional, normal person if you, you know, do everything right. If we can change the environment around us, that's where the solution has to be.
I'm always in my clinical practice, in my one-on-ones with patients, in this podcast, I like to give people what we call tangible health bites, which is why this podcast is named what it is, right? But also, I don't like leaving people with this feeling of like a lack of agency, like, you know, the environment is terrible and there's nothing we can do.
There are some solutions.
Yeah. So talk to us about how do we manage it?
I'm coming from an addiction framework. So the bites that I'm going to suggest come from an addiction platform. And it's the reason why I think you don't have to buy necessarily the whole thing that you're a food addict, but at least hear what some of the solutions, like don't miss out on this bag of tools that we have. And if you find that you cannot eat chips without eating the whole bag of chips, what we would say in the addiction field is That is a trigger that you can no longer play with, so you have to abstain from it. What happens is with the person who's addicted to something is they become hypersensitized to a trigger, so that one little bit, because dopamine is want. And if I have a little bit of something, the dopamine flares. It's almost like a hives reaction in the brain. You get this flare up of dopamine in the brain that makes you want. So a little bit makes me want. So therefore, I better just not have any. Tool is, what are your triggers, and then abstain from them.
So the clearing out your pantry of those things, and like not everybody is a chips monster, like we say in the house, you know, like my husband is a chips monster. I am not, for example, right? So clearing the pantry of those things. I want to ask you a question though, before we move on to the other tools, because this is something kind of a point of contention that I have faced or considered, which is, you know, there are a lot of people out there that promote intuitive eating, right? Which it feels right to me, right? Like using your intuition, noticing your hunger. And that is something that I counsel my patients to, is just savoring the food, noticing your hunger, you know, eating while sitting so that you can really be attentive to your food. But I also feel like when you're in that mode, right, where you know that every time you have a chip, right, you can't, like they say, no one can eat just one, right? And you know you can't, how can you be intuitive in that moment? I'm interested in your thoughts.
So basically, it again comes down to what is a food and what is pathological food. So I can intuitively eat Brussels sprouts because I love them and I'm very happy to eat them slowly or eat them quickly, whatever. And I can, because there is no compelling dopamine drive to push beyond that. But if we eat, you know, and raisins, you know, you see that with the yoga experience, you suck on a raisin or a cherry. Okay, that's a real food, but we can't do that with chips.
They've been created to be dopamine triggers.
Exactly. Yeah. And the dopamine spikes too high for meditative, intuitive eating. So intuitive eating is perfect in recovery from food addiction. I've figured out what the foods are that are triggers. I've removed them from the pantry. Now I go back to the foods that my body's meant to eat, that, you know, like the leptin kicks in after 20 minutes, because that's perfect. It takes 20 minutes to break down that Brussels sprout into a finer carb. So it all works perfectly. And intuitive eating fits into that model perfectly, but it doesn't in the other, because that's a drug.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I like that. I mean, I think we're on the same page. I also want to add that for people who maybe are not, again, buying this whole thing of, or it doesn't fit to call themselves a food addict. And what comes to mind is often parents who will come and tell me, you know, I'm really here because of my son. He's always eating chips, but then my other daughter is really thin. And so we keep it in the house because if she doesn't eat chips, she won't eat anything else, but I don't want my son to eat it. This is such a common scenario. And the answer is, like, you got to get it out of the house. That doesn't mean that he can't go to birthday parties, you know, and never eat it because he's an addict. But it does mean that if you have it so available on a daily basis, it's going to be consumed on a daily basis. I mean, wouldn't you agree with that?
I absolutely agree with that. Yeah.
So the first tool is to clean your environment of your triggers. So what would be another tool that you would mention or that you would advise?
I would probably, you know, the addictive mind is such that I will talk myself into, because, you know, essentially our cognitive frontal lobe gets hijacked by the primitive part of us.
Can you say that again? That's a perfect quote. Because I use the word hijack too. The frontal lobe, which is the thinking part, is hijacked.
It's hijacked by the addictive mind, which is the basically twisting of the reward center, which has been hijacked by the food. So, you know, it will hijack our thinking process and make us want to eat something or talk us into or justify. It's okay. I'm sure you've seen this too. You know, we see that the diabetic who's going to get their foot cut off, or the alcoholic whose neuropathy is so bad, and they say, what's one more day going to do? You know, well, we know what one more day is going to do. It's going to bring them closer to that amputation. But anyway, the thinking process has been hijacked. So tip number two would be, get support to help you. Definitely. I mean, that actually is a two-part thing. Talk to people who are going to say, don't worry about it, Vera, you're skinny, or Adrian, you're skinny, don't worry about it, you can have a little bit. You have to get those people, those voices out of your house too. get the food out of your house and get basically the food pushers, either yourself or your family, out of the house too. You need support. In the same way as if I want to quit smoking, I don't want somebody saying, great, you quit, have a cigar. Of course, that's ridiculous. But we do that with food all the time.
Yeah, it's so funny because I've said this too. And again, it's not to pathologize or to vilify the food, but there is also a movement around, and rightfully so, around addressing bias with obesity. And I'm fully 100% on board with that because there is certainly a bias in our society that is damaging. Sometimes that idea gets translated into, we shouldn't, as physicians, tell people or advise or help people lose weight, because that plays into the shame and the bias. And what my perspective is that we can do this work without judgment. So we can teach people to have self-compassion for themselves, which actually helps them rid themselves of the compulsions and the addiction. And yet, again, I want to use the word agency, give them the tools to know and to feel that they can manage this, right? And maintain healthy weight and have, you know, not have diabetes as a result. So it doesn't have to be either or.
No, no. And in fact, this is a great number, tool number three, or clinical pearl number three, which is, when you're eating well, stop with the, I have to lose weight. Losing weight focus is only going to make things worse. The weight will take care of itself. So when I talk about fearing fat, I'm talking about visceral obesity. I'm talking about the obesity that happens because of refined carbohydrates and sugar, which turn into visceral fat. We're not talking about subcutaneous fat. And if a person's eating a lot of fat and a lot of protein, and they may be getting the obesity of on the hips and on the I don't know, the face and whatever.
Arms or what have you, under the skin.
We always say focus on the obsession to overeat, which is driven by the sugar and the refined carbs or the trigger foods. If you quiet those obsessions, you will then eat foods that will make you a proper weight, and you won't have that visceral obesity, which is what makes people sick. That's the stuff we worry about. But don't even think about it. It will take care of itself. The patient, think about the obsession, and that's the addictive paradigm. What is driving the triggers? And now we're back to number one. What is the trigger? Clean the pantry, get the support, and let the weight take care of itself. That's number three. It will.
Those are all great tips. And I want to also address, you know, the emotional piece, which we've kind of touched on, and something that I talk about often, and actually in my book that's coming out next month, Hungry for More, I describe the emotional and spiritual hungers, right, that manifest as a physiologic hunger for food, but really isn't. And what I find fascinating about this is that you use the term hijack, that the emotions actually hijack our hunger. And this is based in physiology. So when we feel stressed, which we all have to some degree this past year, or do always, but really it's been heightened chronic stress in the past year, that actually hijacks your hunger hormones and makes you believe that you're hungry even if you've eaten. And that's physiologic.
It's like a false hunger.
Correct. And so can you talk about that emotional piece a little bit and what your experience is as an addiction specialist?
Yeah. So one of the things that we talk about in addiction, this is great. You can almost say this is tip number four. I mean, we're coming up with this together.
You got to include me in your next book. Okay.
I will. Yeah. We always talk about addiction as being physiological and spiritual and emotional. So, you know, exactly what you're saying too. And so once the person, and in the 12-step program, which we use a lot because it's the addiction world, you know, the first three steps have got to do with the drug itself and the, you know, quitting the drug. And then you've got the rest of the steps, which are talking about, how do I now live without that substance? How do I fill the hole, the empty hole that I was using the donuts for, or the alcohol for, to fill? That's the spiritual void. That's the spiritual dimension. We now have to put something else in. And so that's what we talk about. And that's why the whole 12-step, they call it a spiritual program, because you have to have something to fill in that hole. And it doesn't have to be 12-step. But I mean, if you see a lot of addiction programs, they're either very medication focused, because they're basically not using a spiritual program. When somebody walks into my room and they have a sense of meaning in their life, whether it be strong family values or sense of meaning in terms of spiritual values, I always have more hope for them because they have something that they can then use to fill in that empty space where food used to be.
You know, I feel like sometimes when we hear meaning, it sounds really grandiose and maybe intimidating. But actually, what I have experienced with my patients and what I have written about, for example, is like hungry for creativity. You know, that's a form of meaning, right? And actually, the studies show that there's chemical changes that occur when we engage in a creative practice. So I think when we think of meaning, like sometimes we feel like we have to be like these saviors of the universe, but meaning can be like an art project. That's meaning.
Yeah, I really like your title, Hungry for More, because addiction, one of the phrases that we use all the time is it's a disease of more. And there you are. It looks like your book is a suggestion of how to address that sense of more, how do you fill that?
Yeah, something other than, well, all the other hungers that come into play. This has been really, I mean, I feel like we could go on forever, but this has been really a great conversation. And I really want to wrap up again with a sense of giving people some tangible and also broad strokes, so to speak, comments, which is, you know, there is this concept of addiction. It is controversial. And so it may resonate with some, it may resonate with, you know, not resonate rather, sorry, with others. But I think everyone can kind of gather little pearls, right? So even if they don't feel like they're in full-blown addiction, there may be little pieces of what has been said that does resonate. And so take kind of what you will and what might help you and apply it. It doesn't have to be, you know, all or nothing. So I really appreciate your input and your steps. I want to encourage people to follow you on your Facebook group. Tell us the name of that group again.
I have a couple of things if I can mention. So I have my Facebook group, which is open and of course free, and it's called I'm Sweet Enough, Sugar-Free for Life. I have a book that I would hope that people read that you can get on Amazon called Food Junkies, Recovery from Food Addiction. And we have a podcast as well that's called Food Junkies, and we interview people in the food addiction field. You can get that on Spotify or iTunes as well. So please check out those venues.
We'll definitely link in the show notes to all of three of those things so that people who are interested can learn more from you, Dr. Vera. And I also thank our guests for being here. If you've enjoyed this podcast, if you think that it will help anybody you know or love, please share. And to those of you who are regular subscribers, if you can like us, share us, and check out dradrianudim.com for updates, including updates on Hungry for More, which I'm so, so excited to share with everyone.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And I hope to talk to you again soon.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode and are inspired to take a small bite towards your own health and wellness. If you love what you heard, please subscribe on iTunes and Spotify or anywhere else you podcast and share us. If you're looking for more inspo, you can find lots of content and sign up for my newsletter at dellnutrition.com. There, you can learn more about me and my curated line of supplements and functional protein bars. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to seeing you again next week.